You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Rick Britton is a Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer. An award-winning historian, Rick also organizes history-related lecture classes in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Thursday, September 22, 2011, Beth Taylor presented the third lecture in our continuing series entitled Virginia History 201, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, A Dynasty of Friends. An historian who's developed slavery-related interpretive programs at both Montpelier and Monticello, Taylor delivers fascinating details about slave life on the plantations owned by the author of the Declaration and architect of the Constitution. Were enslaved African Americans at Jefferson's Monticello or Madison's Montpelier treated any better than bondsmen on other Virginia plantations? This is part 3 of 5. Here's Beth Taylor.
Thank you so much, Rick, and it's a delight to be here with all of you tonight talking about what I think is a very important subject, presidential plantations. And I will largely restrict my remarks to discussing the two plantations I'm so familiar with, Monticello and Montpelier, though a lot of what I have to say would also apply to Monroe and the 80 slaves that he had at Highland. Now, as Rick said, I was involved at Monticello and Montpelier, responsible for historical interpretation. And I saw the opportunity to make a contribution by furthering the interpretation of the African American heritage at these two sites. You know, a lot of us, when we were in school, did not really get the full story on the importance of African American history, how central it is to American history. And all too often, instead, that history was ignored or misrepresented. So we've made great strides in the last couple decades, but there's still work to be done to undo those failings from the past. It's so important wherever slavery existed in the United States, where there are historic sites today, to tell the full story, but all that much more important and poignant to do it at plantations that were lorded over by the author of the Declaration of Independence and the architect of the United States Constitution and Bill of Rights. When I think about this subject, or when I train interpreters to present it at historic sites, I think it's important to look at it from three different angles. One is the overall slave community. What numbers are we talking about? What occupations? What family structure? What free time resistance? There's lots of information about the enslaved community, though never as much as we would wish. And then secondly, to zero in on particular families and particular slaves, because this is the most ready way for us to appreciate our common humanity with these ancestors. And in that regard, I will refer to the book that I've just completed. My subject in that case is Paul Jennings, and he was James Madison's enslaved manservant. And so I'll refer to him regularly throughout my remarks this evening, as much as an example with some continuity as I mention the various facets of plantation life. And then the third way I'm always interested in this topic is to talk about Jefferson and Madison and their views about slavery and race. And you can never, never do justice to discussing slavery if you're not willing to also discuss race. Indeed, The reason why the history of slavery is so important is because it is directly connected to the troubled race relationships that have plagued our country for so many years. And I'm going to start with that third one. Now, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson were extraordinary individuals and made enormous contributions to the founding of the country and to so many of the concepts of being American that we hold so dear. But as slave owners, they were really garden variety types. And one of my take-homes is to impress on you the fact that being a slave at Monticello or Montpelier wasn't very much different from being a slave down the road at some other plantation. So for the time and place, Jefferson and Madison were typical slave owners. They followed the traditions of the day. Now, of course, for both these men, they were dealing with slavery on both a personal level, on a domestic level, but also first as powerful political office holders and then as prestigious retired statesmen. And early on in their careers, they made some efforts to curb the institution of slavery. But by the time they had retired, they seemed to think, in the words of historian Joe Ellis, that silence was the highest form of leadership on the issue of slavery. And they became convinced that it was a problem that would not be solved in their lifetime. Now, this was not because they didn't realize that it was immoral, that it was, as Jefferson put it, an abomination, or as Madison put it, a blot on our Republican character. They knew it was wrong. They wished that it had never been established in America. And at one time, they thought that if importation of new slaves ended, that slavery would just go away, and that would be a way of seeing the end of slavery. But it became clear as the decades went by, and even after, it was indeed against the law to import slaves across the Atlantic starting in 1809 while Jefferson was president. The domestic slave trade was nevertheless robust, and it went in one direction, south. And as the number of slaves and the number of free blacks grew, the numbers became just way too large to ever see an end to slavery by simply ending the overseas slave trade. Because in the end, the problem for Jefferson and Madison, and as they saw it, the problem for the country, was not so much slavery as it was race. The sticking point was race. It'd be good to end slavery. We're all for theoretically establishing an end to slavery through gradual emancipation, but what do we do about the free blacks? We can't share our country with them. And this was the attitude that Jefferson and Madison both shared and understood that almost all of their fellow white citizens did as well, that kept them from acting. Now, in 1816, a new idea came about. Now, this would be at the tail end of James Madison's presidency. Jefferson was already retired, and Monroe would be taking over in March of 1817. And the new idea bubbling up was referred to as colonization. And this was an idea that freed blacks would be colonized outside of the mainstream of America. That is to say, possibly in the Western lands, but more likely on the west coast of Africa or in the Caribbean. And this Madison saw as a possible green light to ending slavery. In other words, he was for what he called the double operation. If there could be colonization, then we could get the green light to proceed with a gradual emancipation. Now, not everyone, Madison felt strongly that any free black that was to relocate had to do so voluntarily. And that wasn't the attitude of all of his white co-citizens. There were others that wanted to see this happen with or without permissions, individual consents, as Madison called it. And interestingly enough, one of his white co-citizens who felt that way was none other than Edward Coles. And his story is really instructive. He was born here in Albemarle County in 1786. So he was a member of that rising generation who Jefferson predicted would take in ideals of liberty with their mother's milk and would end slavery. And indeed, Coles was a devotee of Jefferson and Madison and their ideas about individual rights and liberties. And he became convinced while still a young man that slavery and republicanism were incompatible. And he hatched an idea early on. He was a member of this gentry class that Jefferson was part of and Madison was part of. And he stood to inherit slaves when his father died. He was from southern Albemarle County. And he hatched this idea, and he didn't share it, because he knew his father might, in that case, do something about changing his will. But his idea was that he would make a stand. And when he inherited these slaves from his father, he would free them. Others would talk, but he would act. And this would hopefully inspire others to follow suit. And he went to Jefferson and Madison, and he wanted to enlist their at least verbal support, if only just verbal support, in some kind of recognition that the trail that he was on was the right way to go. And it was so important to him, not only because he knew that slavery and republicanism were incompatible, but also because he cared so much about the legacy of these two men. And he wanted to see them denounce slavery in a very public way as part of their legacy. Well, the funny thing is, or not the ironic part that I wanted to draw your attention to, is that for all of Cole's activism, and he did inherit slaves, and he did free his slaves, and very importantly, he not only freed them, but he traveled with them to Illinois and made sure that they were established with support and positions, jobs, so that they could prove their worth as free citizens. So the opportunity that he afforded the slaves once free was a very important part of his experiment. And yet, in the end, he reverted to type, as it were, and he could not see black and white living harmoniously together. And he supported the idea of colonization, even if the freed blacks were transported by force. Now, a lot of times people talk about slavery as an economic system. Well, Jefferson and Madison didn't free their slaves because they had such financial issues. And this is one important piece of the puzzle, but it's not the whole thing. I want to impress upon you that it was attitude as much as financial strain that that kept these men from acting. Jefferson freed 5 slaves in his will, 2 in his lifetime. This is with a total of 200 slaves. Madison owned about 100 slaves. He didn't free any of his slaves in his will. Jefferson said that to free slaves was like giving liberty to children, like abandoning children. So they had these very paternalistic attitudes that kept them convinced that their slaves didn't want freedom or were not ready for freedom, and this also kept them from acting. When Lafayette came back to America in 1824, he visited Jefferson and Madison in retirement, and he was just shocked and dismayed that these great sons of liberty were still slave owners, and he didn't hesitate to wag his finger at them and let them know what he thought of that. Well, again, they were pretty much silent in response, but Madison did write to Lafayette and say that just to bring up slavery in a legislative body would be like adding a spark to a mass of gunpowder. So this is symptomatic of the way that really the two of them both went to their graves, wanting to see an end to slavery, but feeling like there wasn't anything in the end that they were willing to do about it, either in political terms or in personal terms. Now, let's talk a little bit about what slave life was like at these two plantations in general. And when I mentioned Edward Coles, I said he was a member of the gentry. And you have to remember that Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Coles, they were the top 5%, the very top elite. And so the reason that their homes have been preserved, at least in the cases that we know, like Monticello and Montpelier, it's because all honor is due to these founding fathers, but also because these were solid brick mansions. And one fact that I like to get across to visitors at historic sites like Monticello and Montpelier is that you don't want to leave with the impression that this is how the white folks lived, the way that Jefferson and Madison lived. And what you learn about how the slaves lived is how all blacks lived. Because the fact is that most free Virginians, white or black, were poor and were trying to eke a living out of subsistence farming. So for one thing, Jefferson acting as if slaves were all children who wouldn't be able to have a shot at making it if they were free doesn't quite ring true, because all slaves had skills of some kind. They at least could knew how to work the soil, and many of them had other kinds of skills, and they were joiners, or they were blacksmiths, or they were skilled house servants like Paul Jennings. So when you learn about the living conditions of slaves, they will vary. Like, for example, at the slaves who, like Paul Jennings at Montpelier, who lived in the south yard right next to the mansion and that were house servants, they had quarters that were plank instead of log. They had wooden floors instead of earthen floors. They had brick chimneys instead of wooden chimneys, which just sounds like a contradiction in terms, but really was not unusual. And they even had not only windows, but glass on the windows. This would be considered good housing, and most commonly would be accorded to house slaves, whereas field slaves that lived out closer to the fields they worked would have much rougher housing, and indeed would have earthen floors and wooden chimneys. You see, plantations like Monticello and Montpelier, Mount Vernon, Washington's plantation, they were divided into a series of farms. So some of you are familiar with names like Lego, Pantops, Tufton. Those are all farms that were included in the overall plantation of Monticello, with the home quarter where the mansion was located called Monticello itself. And similar situation at Montpelier. And so the slaves lived in different quarters that would be closer to the fields that they worked. So some of the fields, some of the slaves worked in the fields, and the main crops were tobacco and then later wheat. And this would be men and women. There was special consideration given to women who were pregnant or who were nursing. But otherwise, men and women worked alongside one another in the fields. And then some slaves were tradesmen, or tradeswomen, and they were carpenters, or they were weavers, or they were gardeners, or they were malters and brewers, and so on. And then other slaves were house servants. They were ladies' maids, or like Paul Jennings, they were manservants, they were cooks, and there was a certain hierarchy, but I would always maintain that there was more to unite the slaves with different occupations than there was to set them apart by this hierarchy. And one of the reasons we know that is we know, for example, that in given families, there could be both field workers and house servants. On the other hand, some of the jobs as house servants, there was a certain common practice of them being, of them following in families, being almost hereditary in that sense. For example, at Monticello, very many of the house servants were members of the Hemings family. Jefferson had a special relationship with Sally Hemings, but he would have had a special relationship with the Hemings family anyway because of the prominent position that Sally's mother, Elizabeth Hemings, played. And so it really just followed in a natural way that, well, let me talk about Paul Jennings, the figure I'm most familiar with. His mother was a house servant at Montpelier. Now, slaves' working life began as young as about age 6. That's when they might be called on to babysit or nurse the younger children, or to be errand runners. And then at by age 12, they were full-fledged laboring adults. And any sensitivity shown to keeping young children with mothers, babies and young children with mothers, would end at age 12. There wouldn't be any sensibility in that regard anymore, because that would be considered a full-grown laborer. But anyway, so Paul Jennings, with his mother a house servant, he likely was in the mansion at Montpelier at a young age, kind of under his mother's skirt, and probably enlisted early on to get the post or carry my chair out to the garden and these kinds of small errands. But what it would also do is give the master a chance to observe the youngsters and maybe make decisions about where they would be headed in the future. So in the case of Paul Jennings, he was an intelligent and capable boy. And when Madison became president in 1809, he took Paul Jennings to the White House. So for 8 years, Paul Jennings lived with the Madisons in Washington, serving as a footman in the White House. And I want to make sure that I tell you about John Freeman, because he was one slave who was owned both by Thomas Jefferson and by James Madison. Now, he was a slave who was sold to Thomas Jefferson early in Jefferson's career in Washington, but with an understanding imposed by his former master that he would be freed in 1815. I think this was in 6 years' time or something like that. And Jefferson accepted that, and of course that would affect the price. And then, as he worked in the White House, Freeman was a footman in the White House, and he worked, and by the way, you know, most slaves, many slaves, are known only by first names. John Freeman was always referred to not only by both names, but Jefferson tended to call him Freeman. I think that's because there were other Johns. Because for the most part, slave owners would not deign to use their slave's last name. And this led to the myth that slaves, by and large, didn't have last names. And now we know that, by and large, they certainly did. They had enduring family names like everybody else. And not only did the slave owners tend not to use them, but they liked to promote these diminutives. And this was just a way of marginalizing the slave's existence and kind of tying their identity to the owners. And in many cases, where the name did follow along more prominently, like with Hemings or with Jennings, it started out as the name of a white person. We know that Hemings was an English sea captain, and Jennings was an English merchant himself. Now, where the name Freeman for John Freeman came from, I don't know. But as John Freeman was working as a slave for Jefferson in the White House, he would naturally travel back and forth between Washington and Monticello. And he fell for a woman there. She was a member of the Hemings family. Her name was Melinda Colbert. Now, some of you may be familiar with her brother, Burl Colbert. And the reason I bring him up, I don't want to bring up too many names to confuse anybody, but Burl Colbert is another interesting individual to me because he was like Paul Jennings' counterpart to Jefferson at Monticello. Eventually, that is. But when Paul Jennings first went to Washington, he was only 10 years old and he was a footman. But later, he would become Jefferson's personal manservant and the butler at Montpelier. And that's the same role that Burl Colbert took on at Monticello. One thing I've discovered in my research are numerous cases of interactions between Montpelier slaves and Monticello slaves. But back to the John Freeman story. What happened is that Freeman wanted to marry Melinda Colbert, and she had become free. She had gone from Jefferson to one of his daughters, and then was freed altogether. Now, I should say that slaves were not allowed to, their marriages were not recognized by law. Again, that didn't mean that they didn't get married, that everyone in the community didn't recognize a given married couple as husband and wife, but they would have no access to the courts. They didn't have access to the courts for anything. They had no, slaves had no legal protection. They couldn't go from one plantation to another without a pass. They couldn't have a firearm. They couldn't gather without special permission. And of course, most damning at all, this was a system into perpetuity. If you bought an enslaved woman, then you were buying her offspring and her offspring's offspring as far into the future as one might imagine. Now, when it was, and Melinda Colbert, once she was free, she did go to Washington. And there was a law in Virginia. It wasn't a law until about 1806. But after that time, a slave who was freed in Virginia had to leave the state within a year. And this, as you can imagine, was a big deal. And the point of this was to reduce the number of free blacks who were seen by the whites as trouble, one way or another. When it was time for Madison to become president in 1809, Jefferson was going to retire to Monticello, and he wanted Freeman to come with him. Freeman wouldn't be free until 1815. And Freeman wrote to Jefferson. He could read and write, and Paul Jennings could read and write as well. Slaves, it was unusual for a slave to be literate, but it wasn't against the law until it was in certain places after the Nat Turner Rebellion in 1831. Of course, it was somewhat unusual for, well, let me put it this way. It wasn't unusual for a poor white person to be illiterate as well. And many a person would give just their X on a legal document because they couldn't write their own names. So quite unusual that Jennings learned to read and write while still a slave, and so did Freeman. And we know this because we have extant letters. Of course, you need to have a little bit more than just a letter, because sometimes a letter that a slave has written will reveal by the wording used that they actually got somebody else who was literate to write a letter as they dictated. Sometimes that's never mentioned at all in the letter, but other times it makes it clear that that's what actually went on. But we know that Jennings actually had a pretty nice hand. His grammar and spelling left a lot to be desired, but he had pretty nice handwriting. Now, what Freeman was writing to Jefferson was about was saying, please don't make me go back to Monticello with you, because my wife can't go back to Virginia with me, and I don't want to be separated from her and our children. And this sympathy ploy, if you will, worked with Jefferson, and what happened is that he and Madison struck a deal that Madison would purchase Freeman. Now again, his time as a slave is running out, and in typical Jeffersonian style, he does the mathematical calculation of what Freeman is worth based on his remaining time down to the penny. $231.81. Only time I've ever seen a case where a slave is sold with there being any change as part of the transaction at all. So when Jennings went to the White House, Freeman was there to kind of lend him a hand and probably show him the ropes in Washington. And we can only imagine how both scary and exciting this would have been for Paul Jennings. His first time away from home, and he's exposed to a city like Washington. Now remember, it's not the Washington of today. Washington was a planned city, so it was really just being developed, mostly on paper, when Jennings first went there. And like Madison, he would have gone back and forth between Washington and Montpelier. At least for a good 2 months stay every summer, and probably at least and probably a second time most years as well. Now, that's so interesting because I do like to make the point that being a slave at Monticello or Montpelier wasn't special because you were a famous person's slave, not for most slaves, and not on a day-to-day basis. And yet, I've just given you an example of how one slave went to the White House and experienced a city. And this was because his master was involved, and he was chosen to be part of the domestic staff. One of Dolly Madison's nieces left an extensive memoir, and she talked about how slaves at Montpelier, for the most part, never traveled more than 5 miles away from home. And this was true for the most part, but there were other slaves, both with Jefferson and Madison, who did get to see other places. In the case of James Hemings, he went to Paris, and he was trained as a chef in Paris. He didn't want to come back. And Jefferson said, in a very practical way, said, I've spent a lot of money having you trained to be a chef, and now you say you don't want to come back. Well, he did strike a bargain with him, and he said, I'll tell you what, if you come back and you train another slave in the culinary skills that you've learned, I will free you. And each man followed through on his part of the bargain. Now, one thing that some slave owners, and especially Thomas Jefferson, earned is there's lots of different ways to motivate people. And you can motivate them by fear, you can motivate them by corporal punishment, and certainly those techniques were employed at these presidential plantations, especially when it was felt that, according to the slave master, the slave chronically misbehaved or need to be made an example of in front of the other slaves. On the other hand, positive reinforcement works too. And Jefferson would allow some of the skilled workmen at Monticello to be paid a small wage. He called it a gratuity, just a fraction of what a white hired workman might get, or a piece of the goods. The coopers at Monticello, I think it was every 38th barrel was theirs, and they could use it or sell it so that they would have some investment in what they were doing, positive reinforcement. And the same thing with family ties. They could be encouraged because that would make slaves hopefully more contented, but they could always be used as a lever as well, or a threat that could be held over one's head. And so all of these techniques were employed at both Monticello and Montpelier. You know, one thing that's so important is to appreciate that although there has been a certain myth that has come down where earlier we might have envisioned slaves as these nameless, faceless masses of people trudging off to the fields or to the big house early in the morning and then coming back to their cabins at night and being able to do nothing but just try to catch a few Z's before they had to do it all again the next day. And that's a false picture. The picture that slaves had no real spheres of action or imagination is totally false. Moreover, slaves were individuals, and they had individual ways of coping and responding and individual desires. Some slaves, and I would use as an example John Hemings at Monticello, who was a very talented joiner. And so he took some satisfaction in his work and in being skillful and useful at what he did. Other slaves resisted. And slaves would resist in ways small and large. So small ways might include feigning illness, breaking tools, work slowdowns. One serious way of resisting would be to run away. But this wasn't an easy thing to do, and not that that wasn't only because, well, gee, where am I going to go, or what if I get caught, then I'm really in for it. It was also because you would be leaving your home and family. And it's not as if you could say, I'll be back at Christmas. You'd be walking away forever, even if you did manage to safely escape to a town like Richmond or Baltimore, let's say. Now, at Montpelier, we have another serious case of resistance, and that is poisoning of the master. James Madison's grandfather was the Madison who established the plantation that became Montpelier, and he had sent ahead slaves and an overseer to establish the patent, get the agriculture and the construction of buildings going. And then after some years, he moved there with his family. And just within a few months, he was poisoned by slaves and died. Now, we know about this through court documents. One slave, it was determined, was the ringleader. And it was determined that he would hang. But first, his owner was compensated for his cost. And then the other two slaves were the accomplices, and they were given 29 lashes each and returned to their master. Now, this is really daring, thinking of poisoning or killing your master, not only because you might hang, but because slaves realized that their fate was tied in with the master's. If he was having a hard time economically, he could make the slaves work harder. If he failed, he could sell the slaves altogether for ready cash. You had a question. Yeah, well, that's a good question. That was one of the reasons. Well, there wasn't a full plan. The plan was talking about colonization and who would replace the slaves as the laboring workforce in America. That was one of the reasons why some of the whites worried about it to begin with, because they knew that, at least in the elite class, Most of the new generation coming up very rapidly while they were still adolescents formed an attitude that you work, I bask and visit, you know, socialize. So what would take the place of the labor hadn't been thought through. I mean, the idea of colonization, you know, it's like I compare it to like trying to hold, you know, air in the cup of your hand. I mean, it was an idea that had no legs because the numbers involved, both numbers of people and numbers of dollars, were just undoable. And how the economy would recover besides was, another really... This is why, you know, this was seen... Today, we think back and we think, well, yeah, there's lots of difficulties. That's one thing. But this is a moral issue of such an imperative nature. You know, the time for debate was over long ago. This is something we have to act on right away. But the people in power at the time were willing to just go on and on, temporizing about what to do. Until the Civil War, of course, intervened. Yeah, indentured servitude was one of the ways that labor was provided in the 1600s. And in the beginning, there were both white and black indentured servants. And then somewhat slowly, there came to be distinctions between white servants and black slaves. At first, they tried to make the distinction based on their religious background, not being Christian. Then, of course, a lot of people of African extraction did become Christians. So then the wording of the laws had to change so that it could make sure that if you were black and Christian, that wasn't enough to keep you from being enslaved. And of course, the great advantage of being, of having a labor system where one color is enslaved is, first of all, that the class in power, being of the other color, can feel that, well, this is okay, this isn't immoral because they are different. But also, by physically being different, it became a way to be able to track who was a slave and who wasn't a slave, at least initially. Afterwards, of course, first of all, there were free blacks, but also there were enslaved people who looked very, very white, including, as most of you know, many of the Hemings at Monticello. Remember I said you were a slave if your mother was a slave, and that's what it came down to in the end, no matter how light-skinned you might be. How do you get to be light-skinned? Well, there's only one way, race mixing. So we all know that was going on. Now, if you were, obviously, if you were white enough to, quote, pass, and you were willing to leave the area where you were known, then you could, instead of running away, you could walk away, as it were, and meld into white society. Did you hear the question? He's asking about Madison and race. The answer is that I think he and Jefferson would have agreed more than not on the abilities of people of African extraction. Having made an extensive study of this, I think it's likely that Jefferson and Madison largely agreed. But what Jefferson has that Madison doesn't have is the paper trail. So when you read notes on the state of Virginia, and you read some of the things that Jefferson says about African Americans, your skin just crawls, you know, and you don't even want to say them, repeat them, because they fall so hard on our ears. And Madison doesn't have that those kinds of statements, but he did think that free blacks were lazy and depraved and vicious. And this was the prevailing attitude. And that if slavery ended, that there would be a race war with one race or the other being exterminated, that blacks wouldn't be able to forget the actions that had been taken against them, and that they would be vindictive, and that they would never be satisfied with being the secondary citizens that they were bound to be in the country. You know, one thing that's really important to remember is that even though slavery was only legal in the South after, oh, let's say about the 1820s or so, because one by one the northern states had eliminated slavery. They all had different schemes. But they also always would immediately start passing this anti-black legislation. So one thing I admired about Edward Cole's scheme is that he was determined not only to free his slaves, but to give them a chance to exercise their abilities. But if you, if you give someone just nominal freedom, but you don't give them a chance to have opportunity and earn a living and so on, and then turn around and say, oh, they're depraved and lazy, that's just a circular kind of situation. Yes, ma'am. Well, right, the very rich culture that African Americans developed, you know, started early on. And this is one subject that I do want to make sure that we talk about, is slaves were not constantly, I mean, they had long work days, absolutely, but like anybody else, you want to have a life of meaning. And even in their oppressive situation, they took whatever small amount of autonomy was allowed them by the master, and they were always, you know, sort of pushing the envelope for more. And they would take advantage of what they had to carve out lives of meaning. And they were very involved, for the most part, with family, with religion. And as I say, they were just as wide a variety of different approaches as any group of people would be. Some of them, when they weren't working, they probably did want to just catch up on their sleep. Others of them were more enterprising, and they might make brooms or baskets and sell them and make some money. Let me say a little bit more about Paul Jennings. I didn't have a chance to tell you, for example, about his wife. He married a woman who was not owned by Madison, but rather was on the next farm. Her name was Fanny Gordon. Now, that meant that as she and Paul had children, they belonged not to him, not to the man who owned him, but to the man who owned his wife. And they, when they married, they had to get the permission of each of their masters. And then we know that his bride's master threw them a wedding supper. That was how their marriage was solemnized. They did not live together. It was the sensibilities of the time were such that it was considered, well, they can get together once a week on their day off Sunday. That'll be good enough. So Jennings had to struggle as it was to see his family even once a week. But after James Madison died, Dolly Madison moved back to Washington with Jennings in an integral member of her household staff. So that meant that his family was back in Orange. And then eventually she did sell Montpelier. And not only that, she sold it the very same year his wife died. So now his children in Orange are motherless. His youngest child only 2 years old when his wife died. So he had to struggle and realized that what he really needed was his freedom. And he has a very unique story from his particular journey from slavery to freedom. And I do want to make sure, vis-a-vis my book, that I mentioned that it was Rick Britton who did the original maps and graphics for the book. Oh, the Gilmore Cabin. Yeah, the Gilmore Cabin. George Gilmore was a Montpelier slave, and it was in the we believe that he got his freedom following general emancipation after the Civil War. And so the cabin that you see there is one of the few, perhaps one of the very few or only freedmen's cabin from that early period of emancipation that's available to the public at a historic site.
I want to ask you the name of your book.
My book? Thank you. My book is called A Slave in the White House, Paul Jennings and the Madisons. And it's being published by Palgrave Macmillan. And you can pre-order it on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. Or you can buy it in the bookstores when it comes out on January 3rd.
Oh,
and it'll be on Kindle. You can buy the Kindle. Yes, Ed Cole's story and Edward Cole's story and Paul Jennings' story, they intersect because they were both in Madison's White House. Yes, he was Madison's private secretary, and he was also Dolly Madison's cousin, so he was part of the social scene at Montpelier as well. And he was, in his anti-slavery fervor, he was determined that one thing, at least, that he wanted to be successful at was talking Madison into freeing his slaves in his will. And he thought he had talked him into it, and he was shocked when Madison died and he found out the will instead bequeathed all the slaves to Dolly Madison. And he wrote to his sister and he said, Mr. Madison's course has been most unfortunate for his memory, and for the peace and happiness of his widow, he has not now died without freeing one slave, no, not even Paul. So I think that he and Paul got to know each other pretty well. You know, Paul Jennings would have spent an enormous amount of time in Madison's study as his manservant, and as Madison suffered from rheumatism so badly in his last years, it was Paul who was his constant attendant. He cut his food, he lifted him into salt water baths, he had to assist him just to get from one room to another. So a real intimacy developed between the two. And part of my research was to find his living direct descendants, including his 93-year-old great-granddaughter was still living and was the family historian. And just really by coincidence, because the family had been more centered in Washington, D.C., you know, that's where Paul lived once he was a free man. But it turned out that this particular great-granddaughter and her husband had retired to Esmont, which I didn't know until I researched it. And it was a great honor for me to be able to debrief her and get to know her the year and a half before she died. Well, thank you so much for coming tonight. I enjoyed talking with you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.